This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Dow Jones Industrial Average has been falling like Newton's apple. It has lost half its value in the last 6 months. The wealth of many investors has evaporated. For those who are saving for retirement, their children's college educations, or for other future purchases, this presents a real dilemma. What should they do now? Will the market ever recover? Is anything safe now and in the future? And now that the market's always rise in value paradigm has been shattered, have the rules changed for the average investor? If you're in retirement or facing it within just a few years, what should you do? We're going to talk about that this hour with one of the most successful financial planners in the region and the country, actually. Larry Carroll of Carroll Financial Associates was recently named as North Carolina's number one financial advisor by Barron's. He's been named to Worth magazine's listing of the nation's most exclusive wealth managers 12 times. And along with several other awards, he is past national chairman of the 24,000-member Financial Planning Association. Welcome back. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Mike. Thanks for having me.
And because this seems to be such an extraordinary time, we are also reaching out this hour to someone who can give us some historical perspective. What did people do in other recessions, including the Great Depression, to protect and increase their assets? How did banks, insurance companies, and governments survive? Dr. Robert Kravchuk is professor and chair of the political science department at UNC Charlotte, who focuses on U.S. public finance and budgeting with a particular interest in state and local finance. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mike.
This is a good time to talk about state and local finance, I guess, as we go into the program, because we're struggling in North Carolina, as other places in the country are. But let's begin with the stock market. For years, only big money investors dabbled in the stock market, and then as pensions began to evaporate or being switched over to 401ks and IRAs, ordinary people began to get involved. But with what has happened in recent days to the stock market, the age-old question has arisen, and that is the market a place for ordinary people to be?
Well, I think the answer is an unequivocal yes.
Really?
Simply by looking at longer-term returns in the markets over the last 80 years, I think it's pretty easy to conclude that some portion of the person's money should be there. But, you know, the reason stocks provide higher returns over time is because of this volatility. The higher returns are compensation for what you have to put up with, the roller coaster you have to ride to be a stock investor. Certainly it does not work well when you want in at the top and out at the bottom. It never will. But, you know, I think we've probably seen the bottom in this market. I think we've had a huge flight to safety on the part of the public. And if you just take a step back and think about it, when you look at what safe assets pay, with treasury bills paying less than 1%, with CDs at the bank now paying probably 2.25%, you get safety in terms of predictable value, but can you accomplish your long-term goals with those returns? Most people can't.
But if you rode the market up in the 90s and you felt wealthy, because you probably were if you just stayed with it and made good decisions along the way, and then all of a sudden the bottom drops out, the market, at least the Dow Jones Industrial Average, loses half of its value in 6 months, have you really gained anything? I mean, maybe you've taken some profits along the way, but now your investments are worth half of what they were worth before.
Correct. Hopefully you don't have every penny you've got in the market, first of all. Secondly, when you measure returns, you will always reach different conclusions if you measure from a top to a bottom than you will reach if you measure from a bottom to a top.
And if explain that, please.
Well, if you're measuring returns over the past 10 years to the end of February, you're measuring to a very low point. If you measured to the 10 years to the top in the end of 1999, you're measuring to a very high point. What I would tell the average investor is, The market's never as good as it looks at the top, and it's never as bad as it looks in the at the bottom. The truth is somewhere in between.
If I read your company's February 2nd market update correctly, and this February 2nd is ancient history now, I understand that. You believe that although things are likely to get worse before they get better, you also believe that financial markets, both stocks and bonds, have declined too far to unreasonable levels. And we've been witnessing panic selling. Does that mean if your losses are only on paper, that if you didn't sell, that some of your value is going to come back as the panic subsides?
It depends on what you're invested in. If you're in quality and you're well diversified, the answer to your question is yes, it will come back over time. I will point out that we were right about that in that from early February to early March, it got a lot worse, something close to 15% or more in that period of time. But since then, we're up 17 off the bottom that nobody's really talking about, and based on the futures, we're going to be up nicely today. Here's something interesting in this bad market. From November the 20th until January the 6th, which is about 6 weeks, the market went up 24%. Nobody talked about that rebound. It then turned around and got a lot worse, and now, as of today, we'll probably be up another 20% move up off of that bottom. So what we have at this point is extreme volatility. I'm sure our other guests can talk more about this, but when you look at comparing this market to past markets, in terms of what the Dow or the S&P has moved down, this is the second worst market in history. But looking at the economy, unemployment and things of that nature, this is the worst economy since 1980. And if you look at a long-term chart, 1980 really isn't a blip on the screen. Mm-hmm. And we're not to 1980 levels on the economy.
This does, Doctor, seem like extraordinary economic times that we're going through. It seems that way, and I'm just wondering if it really is, or is this simply because we have more media doing more talking about the bad stuff than we ever had before?
Oh, it's really a little bit of both, I think. There certainly is more talk about it, but it's probably universally true now. Whenever any topic becomes the first topic of choice in conversations between friends at the barbershop, beauty salon, you know, then you know something's really up. Mm-hmm. People are concerned about it.
Well, for years we had the cocktail conversations. We talked about this with Larry years ago when we used to do a regular program together, and how everybody's conversation was about, did you buy this? Did you buy that? I'm up 14%. I'm up 35%. I've made $80,000 in a week on Intel. I mean, that was the topic of conversation in the 90s. Now the reverse is happening, and most of those people who made all that money in the 90s never went through a bad down market like this. So, of course, it would be the topic of conversation now, right or wrong?
Oh, yeah, sure. I think now they want to know, is it time to sell?
Yeah. Let me tell you what's different about this downturn. This is the first downturn when the baby boom has been looking retirement dead in the eye.
Yeah.
They're either retired, as if we've just started to retire the baby boomers, or they're staring it dead in the eye. So this downturn is much more meaningful to a bigger piece of the population than it was 20 years ago.
And 20 years ago, more people would have had pensions?
Absolutely.
And would not have had to worry about the health of their 401k because they wouldn't have had one.
But it's not just the idea that my account's down. It's that my account's down and I'm supposed to retire next year. And how am I going to fund 30 years of retirement?
Well,
I think that's why this is so much more meaningful than some of the past downturns.
I want to talk about that. How am I going to do this if you're a year away or if you're in retirement or if you're 5 years away? But one of the figures that keeps cropping up whenever I do a show about this is the national debt and our total debt, public and private. Our total debt, public and private, topped 100% of gross national product. And the last time that this happened was a very scary year, 1929. Is this time different, Dr. Krafcik?
Well, if you just look at the macro statistics, that's one important figure. Another one is that the market has lost so much of its value in the period immediately preceding the onset of the Great Depression. And beyond that, the real estate market crashed in the mm-hmm. early part of the Great Depression. You know, so there seems to be a confluence of forces here that are similar. But, you know, just looking at differences between then and now, you know, Larry mentions that the baby boomers are staring at retirement. I'm one of those boomers that's looking at it, and my plan A used to be to retire. Plan B was to teach, just to continue to meet my classes, and rapidly Plan B is becoming Plan A, as it is for many of my colleagues at the university.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. But in the 1930s, far fewer people had any expectation of a genuine retirement. People just anticipated that they would continue to work as long as they were physically able to.
Mm-hmm.
Fewer people had pension savings.
And when they couldn't work anymore, they were pretty much in poverty, weren't they?
Yes,
unless they had
were.
Families to take care of.
Hence the need for the Social Security system.
I mean, back in the 20s and the 30s during the Great Depression, people had to tighten their belts. So did governments, obviously. But what did they do? Are there things that were going on then that we could learn from now?
Well, yes. One in particular, belt tightening, austerity budgets. Mm-hmm. What a lot of people discover when things get tough is that a large proportion of their spending month to month is on non-essential items, things that have become habitual, movies, hobbies, books,
$5 cups of coffee.
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, we've heard recently that Starbucks is looking to close a whole bunch of stores as a result of not being able to sustain them.
So just common sense things. Look at your budget and cut way back. You know, in all the conversations that I've had with you and other people, Larry, over the years about investing, several things we talked about regularly, and that was do your homework on what you're buying. Make sure you're buying quality. We talked about dollar cost averaging, which is now's a good time to do.
Now's a great time.
We talked about diversification. But none of that seems to have mattered. What has happened because of the recklessness of big players, and most of us are not big players. Why did no one anticipate this? We never talked about this happening. We talked about the market rising and rising and rising until the baby boomers began to take money out for their retirement, and then there might be a little wobble here and there. We didn't anticipate this. No one did. Why?
Well, I think we underestimated the effects of significant leverage in the system and the idea that once one person, one company could not roll over their debt, the extent to which the system was intermingled and interdependent, and therefore you had a huge domino effect when that happened. There are a lot of people, including our firm, that knew of the problems in subprime. What we significantly underestimated was the domino effect through the credit systems. So even if you didn't own any subprime, any direct exposure to subprime, you may well have owned banks, which we did and a lot of other people did, and you just significantly underestimate the effect as that dominoes through the system. You know, it's created a situation where nobody wants to have any risk at all in their portfolio. And I don't know how people are going to fund a 30-year retirement.
If you don't take some risk, because with risk comes the potential for greater return, right? Okay, don't answer that yet. We have to take a break.
Okay.
Larry Carroll's with us, and so is Dr. Robert Krafchuk. Our program is made possible in part today by Children's Day on the Farm at historic Brattonsville, hands-on activities, historic toys and games, pony rides, and a 19th century medicine show Saturday, March 28th. Details at chmuseums.org. Well, we're going to have the goddess of Kid Rock on the program tomorrow. Lori Berkner's a rock star in the world of children's music. Her concerts sell out and her videos top the charts in internet sales. And she'll join us to talk about her music, her appeal, and we'll also hear about an opportunity to see a rarely produced classic play, Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit, all tomorrow at 9.
reactions to steps taken by Congress and the administration to limit bonuses for thousands of executives, a look at the plan, and why some say the move may undercut the Obama administration's overall economic recovery effort. The Diane Rehm Show, Monday.
As always, you're invited to join the conversation coming up on the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on Listener Funded, 90.7 FM, WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about where we are in the market today and what you should do to be take advantage of what's going on now, as we hopefully are coming at us somewhat, and also how you can recover from this. Larry Carroll is president of Carroll Financial Associates. Dr. Robert Krafchuk is here to provide kind of an historical perspective on all this. He's the professor and chair of the political science department at UNC Charlotte. I said before the break that you said before the break, Larry, that people really don't want any risk in their portfolio anymore. And you don't know how, if they move their portfolio to low-risk investments, how they can make enough money to fund a 30-year retirement.
Because, unless they have an awful lot of money.
Okay. Because, well, even that, you're pretty much living off the principal.
Right.
At no risk. Given what has happened, and I know that your clients are no different than anybody else, I'm sure that they called you and said, get me out of this, right?
We had those phone calls.
What are you telling people? I mean, if you're 5 years away from retirement and you've saved your whole life, you've done everything right, you had this portfolio building and building, and you looked at it back in 2007, you thought, well, I'm going to do it. This is going to happen. And now you're looking at it and you're thinking, I'm back where I was in what? 2001? 1999?
99, 98.
Okay, so if you're a year away or 5 years away from retirement, what are you telling folks to do?
Well, let me say a couple of things, Mike. One is, and before I move on, I want to make this point. Sit down and analyze the numbers. Don't assume things. Whether that translates into putting together a financial plan or doing it on the back of an envelope, but analyze the numbers and do an objective analysis of where you are rather than just thinking you're in big trouble. And I'll reiterate or expand upon that in a second. Let me tell you what I think is going to happen from here. If we go through a deleveraging of this economy, meaning that the consumers and the corporations work to pay down their debt and reduce the debt in the system, which is likely, because I think debt's going to be harder to come by. It's going to be more expensive. Plus, the consumer is going to want to have less risk, meaning less debt in their personal situation. If you're taking your discretionary dollars and using them to pay down your debt, you are not spending those dollars at South Park. So what you have to conclude is if we deleverage, we are not going back to a high-growth economy from here. We're going to a no-growth or slow-growth economy during the time period when we deleverage.
At best.
At best. Okay, if we assume a no-growth economy and that might translate into a no-growth market, if the market is... And I'll just use round numbers. If the market's at 7,000 today, and it's going to be at 7,000 5 years from now, obviously ups and downs in between, but that at some point 5 years later, we're still at the $7,000 level. Have you made any money over that period of time? The answer is no if you're relying on growth. But if you're relying on income, you have made the interest and dividends you receive over that period of time. So if we're right about going into a no-growth or slow-growth economy, I think it makes sense to pay a lot more attention to producing income. So I'm not a big advocate of everybody jumping back into the market if they've jumped out. I think they have some unique opportunities in that a lot of income-oriented investments at this point, which had been beat up pretty bad as people ran to safety, just like stocks have been beat up. You've got short-term corporate bonds yielding 5+. You've got longer-term corporate bonds, preferred stocks, convertible bonds yielding 7 to 10%. And I think you can make a great case for just putting together a very diversified portfolio of high-income-oriented investments as we work through this deleveraging process. Now, here's the important point I want to make. A lot of these people that look at their account being down, the fact that they're concerned about their retirement, in a lot of cases, if they take the current pool of capital and were to invest that in this diversified program of income alternatives and produce a 7% return from the income, my experience is a lot of those people can meet their retirement goals and they don't have to have the market recover to be okay in retirement. Does that make sense?
So, I think it does. But in English, what you're saying is you look for stocks and other investments that are going to return income. They're going to pay dividends on a regular basis, and bank the income from those dividends. Don't spend it, bank it, save it.
Or if you are retired or at the point of retirement, draw it to produce your income.
Okay.
That is what I'm saying. But a bigger part of what I'm saying is that a lot of people that assume they have big problems, if they really take a step back and analyze it, they can get where they need to be with that 7% income, and their problems aren't nearly as big as they think they are when they react to them on an emotional basis rather than an analytical basis.
So I'm not sure which of you to ask this question. Maybe I'll get a different answer from both of you on this question. And that is, if we as citizens are deleveraging and companies are deleveraging, which means paying down their debt, getting rid of their debt, living within their means, even as that is going on, the government has gone crazy in terms of spending to help these banks get out of trouble and these other investment houses get out of trouble. And because Barack Obama had certain goals for his administration, which are going to add costs to the deficit. And we have two wars going on, both of which are off budget, as far as I can tell. Is that going to be, is the savings and the paying down of debt in the private sector going to be offset by this incalculable amount of spending in the government sector?
Well, maybe. And this is a major difference between the early 1930s and the present time. At the onset of the Great Depression, let's say, well before the election of Franklin Roosevelt, the monetary and fiscal policy instruments were used in a very perverse way. They actually made things worse. The Federal Reserve
this
was
is the Roosevelt administration? Or
no,
Hoover?
This is
Hoover.
Hoover. But you know, he's not the only one. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt ran for office on a balanced budget platform. Mm-hmm. The idea was that the U.S. federal credit had to be kept good so that the dollar would remain sound. And so we didn't have deficit spending, really not until 1936, 1938, in that time frame when John Maynard Keynes finally made it across the pond and talked to Roosevelt in the White House and convinced him that it was their duty and responsibility of federal government to attempt at least to ameliorate the situation, if not to prime the pump. Both monetary and fiscal policy in the recent past have been geared towards fighting unemployment. And in fact, this is not very well known among the public, but since around last May, M2, it's one of the measures of the money supply, has increased by over 20%. And this is pretty clearly Ben Bernanke using monetary policy in order to fight unemployment, at least stem the tide. Mm-hmm. So far, we haven't seen the deleterious effects of inflation. As a matter of fact, if anything, the pressures are moving in the other direction, which is also a kind of a perversion. You know, if consumers start to get the sense that prices are going to fall, well, they'll hold on to their dollars and then wait and see if they can get a better deal later, which only hurts the economy more.
But if you're bailing out the banks to the tune of $1 trillion or more dollars, and you're going to add to the federal deficit every year for the next 7 years to the tune of $1 trillion, at some point, we have to pay the bill.
Yeah.
And when we pay the bill, aren't we going to face inflation? And isn't that inflation going to eat away at some of what you just talked about, that's living off your income at 7% a year? You might be okay. But if inflation goes to 5% and 6% and 7% and 10%, you may not be okay.
I think it's a great point, Mike. We've just started to put some gold in portfolios, small amounts, 2 to 5%. We don't have it in all accounts yet. We're early in the process. But the point was made, and it's a great one. Right now, we have more of a deflation issue in the very short term, where automobile prices and home prices are going down. We do not have inflation in the system at this point, but we're certainly setting the table to have inflation in the future. I think if you want to deal with it aggressively, you may use some gold in a portfolio. If you want to deal with it very conservatively, there are government bonds called TIPS that, where what it pays you is a very low rate of interest and then adjusts, adds on the inflation each year. And you're still in government guaranteed paper. So I think we have to deal with that. We have to recognize it is a possibility.
Given the gargantuan debt that we're building here, government-backed paper, what does it mean anymore that this security is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States? We're bankrupt, aren't we?
Well, now you're starting to get onto a topic that, of some recent research. I'm not really finished with it as yet, but the basic question is whether or not U.S. Treasury securities can sustain their AAA rating over the long run.
China's worried about it.
Well, they should be. They're holding a lot of the paper. But I put it to you that if U.S. Treasury securities were downgraded, even by one little nick, I think civilization as we know it would come to an end. The dollar
You're not
would
kidding,
no longer,
are you? You're
no,
not
I'm
kidding.
Not. The dollar all over the world would not be able to remain in its privileged position as the international reserve currency.
And what would that mean? And what are the chances of that happening?
I don't think it's very likely.
Okay.
Even if the numbers look the same as other countries whose sovereign debt has recently been downgraded, mm-hmm. I don't think that the bond rating agencies in their wildest dreams would ever downgrade U.S. Treasury securities. What then becomes the standard for a risk-free asset? You know, what should people hold in their portfolios as the bedrock return? All these things become unknowns at that point. The disruption in the system would be too great. So I think there'd be a lot of social and psychological pressure against it.
Is this sustainable? Are we doing the right things? Is the government doing the right thing at this moment in time?
Well, I would say the government's doing a lot of things under the assumption that sooner or later they will happen upon the right thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that everything they've done to this point, they needed to do something. I'm not sure the implementation of it has been great. I will, based on your previous comment, make the statement, though, the government and the taxpayers may make good money on the quote-unquote bank bailouts. The quote-unquote bailout is done by issuing preferred stock. It pays 5%. After 5 years, it increases to 9%. I think that for the vast majority of that money, they will get paid back, and they will get paid a nice return during the period that it's out, keeping in mind that the government is funding that basically with Treasury bills paying a half of a percent, and they're loaning it to the banks at 5 or 5+. They've got a pretty good spread on that money if they get paid back.
Are the people in government not doing the right things or waiting to stumble upon the right thing because they're operating on an ideological basis, or because they are just not smart enough to do this, or because it's the wrong people who were in – actually, some of these people were in these big banks and institutions, and they're just doing the same thing over from the flip side of the coin? Or is it because we just can't know? Because we've never been through this.
I don't think it's any of those. I think it's because politics get in the way of good policy.
Well, there's a lot of populist anger out there. Is
there
that hurting the situation?
It probably is, Mike. Although, you know, some places like AIG bonuses, some of that populist anger may be justified. But
maybe.
Well, that's complicated, but maybe. When you look at the stimulus package, if you're trying to take this huge amount of money and stimulate the economy, in my mind, the least effective way to do that is to provide tax rebates at the very lowest level to people who, in a lot of cases, don't pay taxes. Mm-hmm. They would take that money, and, you know, I understand this, but, you know, they're basically going to take that money and spend it at Walmart or wherever.
However, helps the economy.
It does. But let me tell you what might help the economy more. If you took the same amount of money and provided tax credits for buying cars and houses and other things that have a much bigger domino effect through the economy because they create jobs mm-hmm. and help solve the real estate market, why would you not do that? And the reason you wouldn't do that is the politics of it.
Well, you're nodding vigorously.
Yeah, I'm with Larry on this one, pretty clearly.
Why would there be negative politics to buying cars and houses? Those are the two industries that have been hurt the worst and which have driven the economy down the most. Yeah. Why wouldn't you want to get those industries back up and running healthily?
There's nothing wrong with the objective. It's how you go about doing it. And I think Larry has hit on something that I think is much, much more direct in its indirects. In other words, you can get at all the ripple effects and the dominoes throughout the economy. It's like a giant web. The basic problem that GM and Chrysler have is not that they don't have enough cash. That's a symptom. What they need are customers.
Yes.
People aren't buying their cars.
Right.
You know, so if you give them a few $1 billion, you get them through a few more months. But at the end of that period of time, if they haven't filled any vehicles, they're going to be back where they started.
People aren't buying cars, and they're not buying Toyotas either. It's not just Chevrolets.
That's correct.
So they're not buying cars because they're afraid that they're going to lose their job. They're being defensive. They're being smart for their personal mm-hmm. economies, which is hurting the national economy. How do you reverse that mindset? How do you say, look, there are thousands of cars on lots across the country. Dealers and manufacturers are motivated to get rid of these. They've dropped the prices. They're offering rebates. They're offering 0% financing on these cars. One company is even saying, if you lose your job, we'll take the car back. I mean, what else do you have to do?
Well, it's an overreaction. People are waiting to see what comes next. You know, so, I mean, part of the crisis is real and it's profound, and there's no question about that. But, you know, let's keep in mind, only 8% of all mortgages are in default. That's a big number, but 92% are current.
I wanted to ask you about mortgages because you're the historian here. And a lot of people are walking away from their mortgages for many different reasons. In years past, people were loathed to turn in a mortgage because it was embarrassing. It was immoral. Is that something that's different this time around? People did lose their homes in the Great Depression and other recessions. Is it worse this time?
I think there's a different expectation that they might be bailed out or there may be fewer or less serious consequences to walking away from your mortgage. I'm carrying two mortgages at the moment. When I took my job at the university, I bought a small house here, but I still have one in Bloomington, Indiana, where my son's finishing high school this year.
Wow.
You know, and you know, I'm just not... I'm loath to do it.
Dr. Robert Kravchuk and Larry Carroll are with us. We'll continue with our conversation in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE. Or you can email us, join our blog, join us on Facebook, or on Twitter by going to WFAE.org/Charlotte Blogs. Our program is made possible in part today by Blumenthal Performing Arts Center presenting K.D. Lang, Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter, performing April 8th at 7:30 p.m. in Ovens Auditorium. Tickets are available at Blumenthal Center. CEO pay and the economic recovery effort, the topic of the first hour of the Diane Rehm Show this morning, reactions to steps taken by Congress and the administration to limit bonuses for thousands of executives, a look at the plan and why some say the move may undermine the Obama administration's overall economic recovery effort. That's next hour, coming up in about 20 minutes on WFAE.
The Water Cooler is the online meeting place for 90.7 WFAE listeners, producers, hosts, and reporters. You can start forums on news topics, engage with other public radio listeners, give us story ideas, or just continue the on-air conversation online. Fill out your profile today and join the discussion at the Water Cooler, WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Larry Carroll has joined us. He's president of Carroll Financial Associates, one of the best financial planners in the state and in the nation. And also with us is Dr. Robert Krafchuk, professor and chair of the Political Science Department at UNC Charlotte, and kind of an economic historian when it comes to governments, et cetera, with regard to all of this. Before we go to the phones, as they're still loading up, in an article in yesterday's New York Times magazine, Warren Buffett was quoted as saying, "When the financial history of this decade is written, it will surely speak of the internet bubble of the late 1990s and the housing bubble of the early 2000s, but the U.S. Treasury bond bubble of the late 2008 may be regarded as almost equally extraordinary." Is that what you guys were talking about when we were talking about the troubles with treasuries a minute ago?
No. I think we were talking about just the flight to safety that has driven yields down so low.
Should we be alarmed by this?
I don't think you should be alarmed, but I think people are going to overlook what happens when they're in treasury bonds, and let's say they're in a 10-year treasury bond that right now pays 2.5. If rates jump from 2.5 to 6, that treasury bond's going to sell for 70 cents on the dollar or something like that, and they're still locked into that 2.5% rate. So I think he's just talking about, one, they're going to miss great opportunities when things move, and two, in a lot of cases, they don't understand the risk of what they own by being so conservative.
But things may not move, as you said, for 5 years or
so. They may not.
So in the meantime, what should average people do?
Well, you know, I've made my case for diversification and income.
All right, if you're 30 years old, what should you do?
For a 30-year-old, I probably have 50 to 70% of the money in stocks.
Because now's a great time to buy?
Because it's a good time to buy, and because the timeline perspective is not the next 3 years. 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years. It's the next 30 years.
Okay. If you're 50.
I'd still have some exposure to stock, but I would have more of these income-oriented things, particularly in a retirement plan where I didn't have to pay taxes on the income for that 50.
And what do you do if you're 50 or you're 60 and you've been in stocks because the market was doing so well and now it's wiser to move in the direction that you're talking about, but to do so, you're not using new money to do this. You have to sell what you have at a loss to get into that. Is that wise, or should you just sit there and not take your losses?
It's such a general question, it's difficult to answer.
You'd have to analyze a portfolio and the situation.
Exactly. I think you got to look a little further than that. Here's the one thing I'll tell you about these troubled times. For that person that's concerned, the first thing they ought to do is be the best they can be at whatever it is they do. You know, if you're looking at teachers at UNCC, if they have to cut budgets, they're not cutting the best teachers. Mm-hmm. So work hard to be indispensable to your company, to be great at your job, and to make sure that you've got a continuing income to ride this out.
Again, you're nodding vigorously.
Yeah. another difference with the 1930s. People had far fewer options at those times, far fewer educational opportunities, especially for women, to enhance their skills, to invest in their human capital, if you will, to make their own earning stream more secure.
Let's go to Brad in Charlotte. Welcome. You're on WFAE, Brad.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Huge fan. I am a little, I don't know how to put it. I'm a little outraged almost at some of the statements that your guests are making about people, that we need to be out buying cars and getting new houses and stuff, when I am, and you mentioned 30-year-old, I am a 30-year-old, and I'm worried about losing my job and whether I can pay my rent, and I'm supposed to go out and buy a new car just because the economy is suffering. I think that's kind of safe to, you know, easy to say when you're sitting over there, but not worried about losing your job, you know?
I don't think anybody said that.
I didn't hear anybody say that either.
Well, we did just talk about buying cars.
Well, I heard him say that we should invest 50% of our income in stocks and bonds and go out. And I heard earlier about buying new cars and stuff, and that it's reducing yields. And that's all nice and well in theory, but for us in practical terms, I think it's hard to do, you know?
I think what we said was that GM and Chrysler were hurting because people weren't buying cars. But we didn't make any recommendation for any particular individual to go out and purchase a vehicle.
Oh, I'm sorry, but... I'm sorry. Okay, I misunderstood that. But this 50% on stocks and bonds, I feel like that's a pretty healthy investment to make when, you know, again, my same point still prevails, that we're all concerned about losing our jobs and stuff. How can, you know, how can we go and invest 50% of our income?
The question was for things like your 401k, how would you allocate that money at this point in time? Where it's already investment-based capital, what would you do with it? And basically the response you're making is that you're hunkering down, and that's exactly what we see. We think most consumers are hunkering down until this thing passes, and it's why I think the economy's going through this large deleveraging process and will not easily return to growth.
Mm-hmm. But as people hunker down, they buy less. When you buy less, they make less. When they make less, they lay people off, which causes the economy, the fears about the economy, to grow. So you buy even less, and the cycle becomes really vicious. That's what's happening here, right?
Well, yeah.
The way out?
Well, a few weeks ago, I was watching a Sunday morning CBS program, and Ben Stein was on with his commentary, and he was talking about how our political and economic leaders were just a little too pessimistic. They should be talking up the economy and restoring confidence. I mean, that's one perspective. Another perspective is that we need a heavy dose of realism, that people should be very realistic about the things they're investing in and take it a little more seriously, spend more time looking at their portfolios, looking at what they're invested in, you know, and listening to people like Larry.
Despite the television commercials that suggest that you trade electronically, can the average person really do this? Does the average person really have the time to research all these stocks and mutual funds and decide what's best for them? Does the average person understand all this, or should they rely on somebody who's professional?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of time. I think people do have the time. I think it's a matter of the understanding and the ability to get their emotions out of the way. Mm-hmm. You know, if two weeks ago today, you were ready to scream and have everything out of the market and, in fact, took that action, that would indicate that you're probably not cut out to be doing this.
Yeah, and yourself. In the 90s, when people were day trading and quitting their jobs to do that, it was a safer bet to do that because the market was going up, 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 up. Now it's going down, 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 and you'd better have a fallback position, it seems to me, right?
Investing is a lot of fun for a lot of people in the up markets.
It's not
quite as much fun in the down markets.
Brad, thank you for your call. Let's go to Hickory. Robert, you're on WFAE.
Hey, Mike, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My big concern with all of this, and I think I speak for a lot of the average American consumers out here, we're bailing out all these banks, and thus they're taking this money and sticking it in their pockets for big bonuses and all this stuff. If you took that same money and you put it in the pockets of the people on the street, then spending would be up. Thus, people would be paying their mortgage. That wouldn't, you know, that would certainly have an effect on the housing market, plus that money would have to go through due process, so there would be less corruption involved. The people who weren't in a mortgage situation would be out buying cars. We're taking all these trillions of dollars and giving it to the big corporations, and nobody's taking care of the common taxpayer, and we're the ones that's paying for all this. I don't understand why we can't invest in the Americans who support this country.
Who wants to take that?
Well, as Larry indicated a few minutes ago, the question of bonuses is a very complicated one. people are, you know, angry at it.
Why should you get a bonus for destroying the company?
Yeah, and then that's a good question. But let's start with Fannie Mae. When the president of that company, he lost 90% of its market value, and he walked away with around a $90 million bonus.
Well, it's immoral.
He was Bill Clinton's budget director.
I don't care.
As a matter
it's
of fact.
Bad business.
Well, no, it is bad business. And a lot of the bonuses that people have focused on is money that was paid to people who have already left the companies.
Yes.
Now, if you're going to bring in a new management team that's going to help right the situation and you want to tie their compensation to the future performance of that company, then you should be able to pay those people bonuses because they're part of the solution and not part of the problem. That's forward-looking. You know, so some of the legislation that's being considered right now in Congress is directed at the former, but it's going to hurt the latter.
Do you worry about that going forward, that there'll be some sort of a pendulum swing in terms of regulation that will hurt business, hurt investors in the long run down the road?
Well, I think you have to worry about it. I think you have to be very concerned about what happened late last week where they took the action of we're just going to tax the bonuses at 90%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in some cases, the company had a contractual obligation to pay that bonus.
Yeah, but contracts are revised all the time.
By the government?
No.
You'd feel good about it if the government came in and revised your contract with WFAE.
If I had one.
If you had one. I'm not defending the bonuses. I'm just saying that it's more complicated than the average person looks at. A great example is a bond trader at one of the major banks.
No, the government shouldn't go in and do that. But
right.
if I'm the CEO of Big Bank and I'm coming to the government saying I need $56 billion right now, but I'm going to take $187 million of that 56 and I'm going to pay it out in bonuses to guys who destroyed my bank, why wouldn't the government say, okay, we'll give you the $56 billion, but you've got to go in and tell those guys that they are not going to get their bonus.
If you're paying it to the guys that destroyed your bank, I agree with you. What about a guy that's a bond trader at, say, Bank of America? Very profitable bond trader. He's made $100 million a year, every year for B of A. But his compensation structure is a $200,000 salary and a $2 million annual bonus based on results. And last year, he made the $100 million for the bank that he normally does. What you're saying is he's not entitled to his bonus. One, he didn't have anything to do with the problems. Mm-hmm. But two, what you're going to force the banks to do is to change the compensation structure for that person where he gets a $2 million annual salary regardless of his results rather than a very low salary and a bonus based on his results.
Jane writes, I have a POA. I'm not sure what that is.
Power of attorney.
Okay. For my mother who is now in assisted living with expenses between $4,000 and $5,000 a month and assets of $180,000. I have legal guardianship for my mentally handicapped brother with expenses of $3,500 a month and assets of approximately $175,000. Both have medical conditions that could worsen at any time. I'm feeling quite overwhelmed about properly managing their finances, and I'm concerned that if their medical conditions worsen, there will not be enough money to sustain them. My brother lost $11,000 in the market in just the past 45 days, and my mother is not faring much better. Should I sell a majority of their assets and put them in CDs just to stop the bleeding?
Very difficult question. You know, in both cases, if I'm doing the math right, there is not enough capital there to sustain the monthly expenses on a long-term basis. So by being at risk, you're probably going to run out of money. It just gives you a wider time frame as to when you run out of money. By taking everything out and putting it in CDs, you still run out of money, but you have a much more specific point in time when you will probably run out of money.
Mm.
Neither one solves the problem of not having enough capital.
She should see a planner.
And she should understand that she has a very difficult situation.
Okay. Very quickly, let's go to Scott in Charlotte. Welcome, Scott.
Hi, this is Scott. So my situation is a microcosm of what we see, I think, in the bigger economy. I own a house in Massachusetts. I rent a house here in Charlotte. I'm trying to sell my house in Massachusetts. It's just not moving. We've dropped nearly 100,000 or 25% in its value a year. How do you see the end of this? You know, where does one go when in such a situation?
I don't think there's any easy answers to that at all. At some point in time, you have to make a decision of, are you going to dramatically cut prices? Are you going, and he already has cut them fairly dramatically. Are you going to just try to wait this thing out? Are you going to bite the bullet and let a mortgage be foreclosed on? There are no good or easy answers to this process. Mm.
And that's part of the problem, is that we live in an instant gratification society, and suddenly we see no answers. We don't know where the bottom of all this is, and it looks pretty scary. Anything from history that will help us feel more comfortable very quickly in 10 seconds?
No, not really. there are just too many possibilities here to really know.
Dr. Robert Krafchuk is professor and the chair of political science at UNC Charlotte, and his interest is on U.S. public finance and budgeting. And Larry Carroll, of Carroll Financial Associates, recently named as North Carolina's number one financial advisor by Barron's. Thank you both for being here. I wish you had much better news. Come back when you have some.